Welcome to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk. Here's your host, Jason Davis.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Wednesday. Welcome into World Soccer Talk's Soccer Morning right here. Live and ready to go on a Wednesday, man. Oh, man. Oh, man. What a time to be alive. Maybe not the best time to be alive if you're a U.S. men's national team fan. I mean, it's great to be alive. Let's be thankful that we're alive, but things not going well in the world of the U.S. men's national team. We'll get into all of that. We'll talk about Mexico today as they continue their domination in the CONCACAF region. Saw something from our friend Tom Marshall on Twitter. They are current owners of the CONCACAF titles in the U-17, U-20, U-23, and senior levels. So it's a good time to be a Mexico fan, not so good a time to be a U.S. national team fan. All right, so lining this up today, Eric Gomez joining us at 9:10. Get into everything Mexico with Eric, as always. Look into the success of the program, where things sit as Tuca Ferretti exits stage left and Juan Carlos Osorio takes over. We also have on this program at 9:40 a.m. Eastern Time, John Townsend, a writer who's been published at These Footy Times, The Guardian Sport, a couple other places. I imagine John and I will have a healthy debate on the structure of American soccer right now. I figure we'll have some common ground, but if you've been following me on Twitter, you know where this started. But we're going to give John plenty of platform to get his views out, and we'll have a discussion. It's part of why Soccer Morning exists, so we can do these things. Very excited for today's show. Two very good guests, lots of news, lots of things to cover, and we'll probably take some phone calls at the on the backside of those two guests. Let's start with the news in European qualifying. The Dutch are out, finished third at the World Cup in 2014. They have been eliminated from the European Championships after losing 3-2 at home to the Czech Republic last night in Holland. Not good for Danny Blind and company. Up a man at a point in that game, unable to make the comeback, giving up 3 goals at home. It is done for the Dutch. The Turkish are in to the European Championships. They have qualified automatically, as the best third place team in qualifying with a 1-0 win over Iceland. Selçuk İnan's, I'm trying here, 89th minute free kick goal gives Turkey the win over Iceland. Remember, Iceland's already qualified, so they now proceed into the tournament as the top third place team. The pots are set for the playoff draw with those other third place teams. Everybody else who finished third place is now into a mix to go into the playoffs. Your top pot, Bosnia Herzegovina, Hungary, Sweden, and Ukraine. That means they cannot play each other. They will be drawn against Denmark, Ireland, Norway, and Slovenia. So there's your 8 teams still vying for spots in the European Championships, 4 spots to go. The U.S. men's national team, as mentioned, not going well. They followed up Saturday's CONCACAF Cup loss to Mexico with a 1-0 loss to Costa Rica at Red Bull Arena last night. Joel Campbell did the honors for the Ticos, and the attendance was a paltry 9,200 people. Not good in the world of American soccer. The U.S. U-23s, just to actually give some glimmer of hope, beat Canada 2-0 at Rio Tinto Stadium to book a place in the playoff for the 2016 Olympics against Colombia. There was some confusion. Originally, it was thought that there was going to be a one-off playoff in Rio in March of 2016 for this spot. Turns out, this is all from Leave You Bird on Twitter from SI, it turns out there's actually going to be a home and away aggregate series between the two countries, but also in March of 2016, adds a new wrinkle. Obviously, lots of work to do for Andy Herzog and company. It's a very young Olympic qualifying team. We'll see if any changes are made ahead of that tie with the Colombians. FIFA presidential candidate Prince Ali bin Al Hussein has spoken out against the idea of delaying February's planned election, saying that a delay would further damage the credibility of the organization. The election is set for February 26th. This is obviously to replace Sepp Blatter, who has said he will stand down. There is an emergency meeting of FIFA Executive Committee next week in which they will discuss potentially delaying the election. Now, this is all because of the turmoil. Michel Platini suspended, Sepp Blatter suspended, numerous FIFA officials being suspended and or indicted. Things are not good at FIFA, but I agree with Prince Ali. You can't delay the election. It mentally makes you look worse. Speaking of South America, CONMEBOL World Cup qualifying, Brazil bounces back from their opening round loss to Chile with a 3-1 win over Venezuela at home yesterday. Argentina settles for a goalless draw with Paraguay and now has just 1 point from their first two matches. The Albiceleste were without Lionel Messi and Sergio Aguero, both out with injury, obviously, that have a major impact on their ability to score goals. Elsewhere, Ecuador beating Bolivia 2-0. I watched a tiny bit of that game on BN Sport, and man, they were playing on a pond there in Quito. Not good playing conditions. Ecuadorians scored twice in the closing minutes to get the win. Uruguay 3-0 over Colombia. Not great for the Colombian senior team at the moment either in World Cup qualifying. Peru losing at home in a thriller 3-4 to the defending South American champions Chile. MLS Wednesday night, big set of matches, three matches tonight on the schedule, all of them having something to do with the playoff picture in Major League Soccer. You've got Toronto facing New York Red Bulls at home. The Red Bulls can clinch the top spot in the East if they can win away to Toronto or draw with the Reds there. Interesting note, I saw some mention on Twitter yesterday that Sebastian Giovinco, although he played a role in Italy's World Cup qualifying yesterday, was texting Toronto's staff saying he wanted to be involved in tonight's game. We'll see if Giovinco, after flying back from Europe, I imagine overnight, will have anything to do with the proceedings against the Red Bulls this evening. FC Dallas can take a big step towards the West top seed with a win over Vancouver tonight. A win and a Sporting plus Galaxy loss on the weekend would give FC Dallas the top spot in the West. Seems unlikely that scenario will all play out this weekend, and we may have to wait another week to see who gets that top spot. But it is here for FC Dallas if they can beat Vancouver tonight. RSL hosting Portland. Neither one of these teams can be eliminated, I don't believe. Portland or secure their spot. Portland does need points desperately in the West. Right now they sit just outside the playoff places in sixth place, but they are tied on points with the San Jose Earthquakes. They can also do some, if they can beat RSL and put a decent number up, they can actually do some damage towards that goal differential. Although I believe first tiebreaker in MLS is wins, so they would actually, if they won, they would take the tiebreaker away from San Jose, with San Jose set to play on the weekend against Sporting Kansas City. All right, we have run through most of the headlines, got a gigantic show for you. Eric Gomez, he'll come up next. John Townsend following that. Good stuff on a Wednesday soccer morning. Wow. Hit us up at Soccer Morning. You got any thoughts on any of the things we talk about today? Always glad to get your opinions in. We'll talk to you in a second. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. Facing the crowd. You're talking too loud.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
All right, here we go back on Soccer Morning. Grabbed a good friend of the show, Eric Gomez. Going to talk about Mexico and the triumphs of Mexico. Yes, this might be painful to U.S. national team fan ears, but alas, it is the state of things. You can find Eric on Twitter at EricGomez86. And Eric, how are you, sir?
Doing great. Last night was another late night for us covering Mexico up in Toluca, but despite the quality of the game, it was a pretty decent event.
Yeah, you know, it was such a weird letdown after Saturday to have friendlies follow up that matchup between the U.S. and Mexico, and obviously, you know, Mexico triumphant, winning the CONCACAF Cup and booking their place to the Confederations Cup and succeeding over under interim head coach Tuca Ferretti, and then having to play Panama. I guess we can start last night, and if you take anything out of that game at all, I mean, you know, Klinsmann wants to put the U.S. loss to Costa Rica on some sort of letdown. Apparently Mexico didn't have quite the same sort of letdown.
Yeah, I think it was pretty obvious that, you know, one of those two teams was going to have a victory lap, obviously, and the other one was going to have a letdown after Saturday. You were just planning kind of a weird Russian roulette if you were Mexico in that regard, because Tuca Ferretti would have had his last game no matter what against Panama. So I think it was pretty strange for CONCACAF and for both federations to plan out their FIFA dates that way, but it all worked out for Mexico. You can't blame him for that. And we saw a game with a lot of spare parts on the Mexican side. You know, Chicharito, Rafa Márquez, Andrés Guardado, none of those guys were available. They went back to Europe, so you had a couple of pretty decent first-teamers like Carlos Vela and Jonathan Dos Santos, etc., but mostly Liga MX guys facing off against Panama and Toluca. And again, Panama, they've been incredibly hard on Mexico, I think, for the last couple of years. So it was a decent match in terms of the way that the opposition presented itself. And Mexico got another win. It was, like I said before, it was a victory lap for Tuca Ferretti. It was a pretty decent event for Mexican national team fans. And we were switching our attention between that game and the U23 championship against Honduras, which was also a pretty hard-fought game. So, like you said before we got on the call, Mexico pretty much has every CONCACAF trophy right now, and they're going to go after another one in the U17 World Cup next week. Yeah, so we'll see how that goes.
I'm going to come to that, and we'll take stock of the Mexican team heading into the U17 World Cup, which is the far reaches of real, truly competitive youth international soccer. Makes it tough. It's hard to even imagine, you know, which of those players are going to come good and be part of the senior team one day. But we'll come to that. Tuca Ferretti, apparently he made a bet he made a promise that if Mexico won on Saturday, he'd shave his mustache. What's up with that?
Yeah, I mean, it was weird, wasn't it? It was like kind of, you know, I think this is an experience that's not necessarily endemic to Mexican kids, but I know a lot of your listeners probably had this happen, but it was kind of like the first time your dad came home from the barbershop and had shaved his beard or his mustache off. And
that was the
first time you had ever seen him.
Eric, it reminded me of Tom Selleck. And there have been moments in the past, like 30 years, where Tom Selleck has been without mustache, and it just does not look right.
You're right. Yeah, it's exactly that's exactly the parameter by which we're going to be judging Tuca. He's a Mexican Brazilian Tom Selleck. It was strange because I think for the entirety of his career and what we've seen from Tuca Ferretti in the last 30 years in Mexico, it's a long, long time. He'd never shaven that mustache off. So he did that, and he just looked weird. He didn't look like Tuca for the longest stretch of time, every time the camera would pan to him.
Yeah, obviously, look, he's an interim guy. He knew his time was going to be up after the Panama game last night. It's a free roll for him. And obviously there's camaraderie there. There's something working. He got something to click. But now Mexico's got to move on. And before we come to some of the other things happening in the region, U23s, U17, and the like, what does the transition to Juan Carlos Osorio look like? I mean, first of all, was Juan Carlos Osorio in-house last night taking notes? Because that's what he does.
Yeah, he was. He was a couple of palcos away from the from the press. He was a couple of boxes away from the press, and he was taking notes, and we saw a lot of that red pen, which is not very good news for the Mexican players who were playing last night. Some of you don't know, and of course, Chicago and New York fans will know, that the blue pen means he's happy with what he sees, and the red pen means that he's not so happy with what he sees. So we saw a lot of the red pen last night, and I think the bar is set pretty high for him. Even though this was an interim job from Tuca Ferretti, this went about as smoothly as it could have gone. And we saw a lot of camera gesturing from Osorio. he did not seem very happy with what he saw. There was a very, very pointed shot of him kind of yawning during the game. So I think that's the kind of thing. And we all know that Osorio is a special character. He's a special kind of guy, very studious, very intelligent, very I would kind of put him in that Klinsmann mold in the way that he just doesn't really seem to care about what people think about him or what the press seems to think about him. But you can't really say that he's getting off on the right foot. He has another chance. I'm getting ready to go to the Mexican national team base here in Mexico City in a couple of hours to see him live for the first time. But it's weird how he just doesn't seem to care, and he's not very media friendly at all. Very awkward coming off the plane. And then Toluca, he seemed bored. He seemed bored. It was not the best game, but I mean, man, you're the national team manager. Show a little more interest in that. So I think the fans are picking up on that. And the choice was not popular in itself, hiring Osorio. So it's going to be a bit of a harder road for him than he would have anticipated, even with the caliber of team that he's inheriting and even with the psychological moment that he's inheriting in the Mexican national team. So it's going to be very interesting today. I've got a couple of questions ready for him later on. Here's hoping the FMF lets me ask him. We expect about 100, 150 media members to be at that press conference, so it's going to be pretty wild.
Do you think that Osorio will have to wonder that if he has a misstep or two? And you know, for as well as things are going right now, the last World Cup cycle showed that, you know, Mexico isn't always just going to walk to World Cup qualifying. Is there a chance he's going to be looking over his shoulder? And whether or not Ferretti, you know, declares himself ready to try again or to do it if necessary, there's definitely going to be a clamor. Well, Tuca did it. Bring Tuca back.
Absolutely. He should look over his shoulder. I mean, CONCACAF has been murdered for Mexico over the last 3-4 World Cup cycles. Nothing has come easy for those national team managers, and we've seen a lot of heads roll. Going back to 2001, that made Javier Aguirre's career. He stepped in late. Mexico was in danger of not making the World Cup. He put him through. And of course lost to the United States in the 2002 World Cup, but then he did it again in 2009. So I think you do need a special, certain kind of coach to take you through CONCACAF if you are Mexico, because we've seen a lot of other coaches with very distinguished records not make it. And Osorio is definitely in that mold. He has a distinguished record in Colombia. He's coached some pretty important teams in Latin America and in MLS. He has experience with the Mexican game. It's going to be very difficult to see him struggle if indeed that is the case. So should he be looking over his shoulder? Yeah, because this time the FMF learned their lesson. And they didn't even make that big of an economic commitment to him. I mean, he's making about half of the amount of money that Miguel Herrera was making with the national team. He's making way less than Sven-Goran Eriksson made. He's making way less than Javier Aguirre made the second time around. And he's making way less than Chepo made. All of those guys were fired, with the exception of Aguirre.
Yeah.
So if he gets off to a rough patch, I don't think there's going to be any type of patience for him, especially if he's not popular amongst the fans.
Okay. Mexico, obviously, World Cup qualifying in CONCACAF begins next FIFA date. That's November 13th and 17th. Mexico hosting El Salvador to start things off. That's about as soft as it gets, unless Canada was coming in, Eric, and no offense to our Canadian friends. And then going to San Pedro Sula, which is a difficult place to play. So he's gonna have something of a test right off the bat.
Yeah, and El Salvador is, again, one of those teams that you look at them on paper and you say, this is going to be pretty simple pickings for any of the big teams in CONCACAF, Mexico, the United States, but they have a lot of fight in them. And I think you get this effect where Mexico and the United States are looked at as the giants. And I think that definition and that perspective is coming more and more from other teams in the region, and much less from fans and media within those countries. I know that in Mexico, that term is kind of ironic now, to call Mexico and the United States the giants of CONCACAF. But you get teams like El Salvador, you get teams like Honduras and Panama and Canada and whoever coming into those games, and they've got that extra 10-15% about them And the games have gotten a lot closer in recent years. So to have those first two games involve teams that have been pretty hard on Mexico, especially Honduras, is a very interesting test for Osorio. And we all know the quirks of Juan Carlos Osorio. We know that we'll probably not see the same lineup against El Salvador than against Honduras. We know that we'll probably not see the same tactics against those two teams. And we know that we'll get these long, rambling, Bielsa-esque press conferences, regardless of whether the game ended in a win, draw, or loss. So I think these are really important. And I know that we're getting into a lot of PR-type talk now, but I think it's warranted because Mexico and the Mexican media have become increasingly dependent on coaches who make life a little bit easier for them and who make relating to them a little bit easier. There was a pretty long honeymoon period with Miguel Herrera because he was just so confident. He was just so open with media and fans. Tuca Ferretti, we expected him to be his same gruff self, and he came in to the Mexican national team with just a completely new attitude about him, and everybody loved him, and they want to keep him. That's not going to happen, but we'll see what happens after a few months of Osorio. So to look at the coaches now with Mexico and the United States, Juan Carlos Osorio and Jurgen Klinsmann, you have to wonder whether it's nice to have the backing of your federation, which Klinsmann definitely has and Osorio definitely has right now, but is it worth it to have a guy who's not a man of the people? You know, because as soon as he's not producing, we know what can happen, and we know the ugliness that can stem from that.
All right, let's move down a level. Let's talk about the U-23s. They win the tournament, the Olympic qualifying tournament. They had already qualified by winning the semifinal, but here they are lifting the trophy. They get an own goal from Brian Acosta, a goal from Victor Guzman. And they win the thing, they cap it off, and I guess with the question that we talk, I mean, not only is it, let's, you know, getting yourself into the Olympics, of course, Mexico's the defending champion of that tournament, but also the talent that's there, the potential players that can move up. I mean, the senior team, I'm not going to say it's loaded necessarily, Eric, but there's a lot of talent, obviously, at the top level in Mexico between Guardado and Chicharito and Layún and Herrera and everybody else, so... Are we seeing players that we should expect to come through in relatively short time frames, or are we seeing guys that are going to be on the fringes over the next couple of years?
And again, we go back to Osorio and the way that he's managed youth at his clubs. I think so. I think we're going to see a couple of those guys suiting up for Mexico pretty soon. And, you know, you think about the types of guys who play for Mexico at the U-23 level, the style of play that they developed. There's a couple of guys, Irving Lozano, he won the trophy for best player in that tournament. He already had an approach made by PSV earlier this summer. He ended up not going, but he's a fantastic talent. I think he's a guy who you have to look at in terms of carrying that mantle, the style of play that Mexico usually wants to employ. The Tecatito, Giovanni, Carlos Vela style of play of, you know, guys who are able to run down the wings, guys who are able to cut inside and juke a couple of defenders and make a nice shot on goal. That's Irving Lozano in a nutshell. He's a fantastic talent. And I think that Pachuca will make a lot of money when they eventually decide to sell him. You got to realize that there were some pretty high profile names not on this team. So Mexico can actually get stronger without even invoking that over 23 rule at the Olympic Games. Jürgen Damm was not selected to that team. Tecatito Corona is available for that team, being that he's 22 years old. Chivas had about 8 players who the U-23 wanted for that pre-Olympic tournament roster. They ended up getting about 4. So there's about half a contingent from Chivas, a pretty good contingent, who they have still yet to call up for other U-23 commitments. So you're getting a lot of very interesting players coming up through that system. Eric Aguirre, who is the youngest player on that team from Monarcas Morelia, is a guy who I would definitely look at for the next 12 months, despite the fact that he's 18. And then you've got the goalkeepers, and Gibran Layud was very impressive in that tournament, a guy who is playing now for Tijuana, but belongs, I think, to Cruz Azul. And I mean, the fact that you had Raul Gudiño, who's backing up Iker Casillas at Porto, as your backup in the U23 pre-Olympic tournament is pretty wild for Mexico. Mexico has always been that national team that develops 6, 8, 10 goalkeepers who are national team quality. And I think that this is where Mexico and the United States have had the most in common over the last 10-15 years. Mm-hmm. But Raul Gudiño is a guy who many are touting as the goalkeeper of the future for Mexico for the next 15-20 years. So you should definitely expect at least 3 or 4 of those top guys to come through the system and to play for Mexico in the coming months. So I know that a lot of the talk that we've had regarding the United States men's national team in Mexico has been, look at the level of talent, look at the youth players, look at the guys who are being developed. That's pretty disheartening for U.S. fans to hear me talk about these guys, because they are pretty special. So, you know, there's more coming down the pipeline for sure.
This Mexico roster for the U23s, I think it's probably fairly average in terms of the makeup in ages. And, you know, what is interesting, and just because we're always comparing, what's interesting to me is a lot of talk about the Americans taking a young squad to this tournament. Guys that are, you know, there's a 17-year-old on the U.S. roster, for Christ's sake. I mean, we're talking about Cameron Carter-Vickers being 17, Emerson Hyman's 19. There's a lot of 18 and 20-year-olds on this team. Mexico, I imagine, still has some guys that are in that age range between the U-17 team and the U-23s, in that U-20 range, who are also pretty close. Did I lose Eric? I seem to have lost Eric. All right, well, I guess we'll, I don't know what we're going to do. We'll try to get him back. Do you want to try to get him back? We seem to have lost the connection to Eric Gomez down in Mexico. Let's see if we can get him back on the air and continue this discussion. Certainly want to go into the U-17s for Mexico going into a World Cup. The Americans will be down there as well. If you look at the group stage of that tournament, as things kick off next week, actually, I think games start on Saturday, as a matter of fact. Eric, are you with me?
Yeah.
Okay. Apologies for that brief interruption. So I was asking about the basically the U-20 age group for Mexico, because again, this U-23 team went and got the job done. These are guys who have aged out of the U-20 group. There's got to be a group of players in that age range who are almost there as well.
Yeah, there are. And again, if you look at the 2011 team that won the U-17 World Cup in Mexico, a lot of those guys have progressed to the next levels of the youth development. So there's definitely a group of guys that are ready to take their place. And if you look at the guys that are going to the U-17 tournament in Chile, you'll see plenty of players who are coming from the prestige programs in Mexico at the club level. And some of those teams have been replaced, actually. Whereas in the 80s and the 90s, you could always count on teams like Pumas to develop youth players. Now it's Pachuca. Now it's Tijuana to an extent. Now it's León. And some of the old powers in America and Chivas. I've gotten a pretty good look at the Mexico City teams and their U-17 and their U-20 squads. And it's interesting to note that I think youth coaches are really trying to hammer a system, a national team system, more so than a club system, into these players. And when you look at Cruz Azul and you look at Pumas and you look at America at the youth level, they're developing players who are ready for the national team and might conflict with, you know, rosters that are laden with foreigners at the club level. And it doesn't really matter, because they find a way to get out, even if it's not with their current teams. So the interesting thing to note here is that they're developing a system. They're really developing the Mexican style of play. And when they get to the national teams at the U-17, at the U-20, at the U-23 level, they're not overwhelmed. They know how to play together almost instantaneously. So there's definitely a group of guys who I would look at for these next tournaments and for these next World Cup cycles at every level, at the U-20, at the U-17 level, because now it's more about continuity. When we had the 2005 team, the U-17 team that won the World Cup, you only really had 3 players who stood out from that. And here we are 10 years later, still talking about Carlos Vela, Giovanni Dos Santos, and Hector Moreno. But there was a lot of great talent on that team that, that just never got over that hump. 2011 team is not in that mold. You now have 6-7 players who are making the jump to first division football and Europe and the national team. And I think as we move along and that system becomes clearer and clearer and more easily developed for all those teams, you'll see a lot of players make the jump.
All right, so the U-17, let's talk about the U-17 World Cup in practical terms. Again, it's kicking off very shortly, the 17th, the first game for the United States against Nigeria. They've got a group, just to give people some information, Chile, Croatia, Nigeria, and the U.S. in Group A. Mexico, a little bit tougher because alongside Australia is Germany and Argentina in Group C. What are expectations? I mean, I imagine getting out of, and look, third place teams can qualify for the knockout stage. So there is hope here of, there is a path here that's not overly difficult. You don't necessarily have to finish above Germany or Argentina to make it, but there's got to be expectations because Mexico succeeded at the youth levels.
Yeah, I agree with that. But, you know, again, Jason, I think we sometimes look at U-17 programs and U-20 programs and we equate them with the senior team level.
Right. Yeah.
If that were true, you know, Mexico would be competing for a World Cup title every 4 years because, you know, Nigeria would be doing that. Nigeria has been amazing at the youth World Cup level. They haven't been able to translate that into the senior team level. I think that happens inversely as well. So, you know, you look at Mexico's group and you go, wow, you've got Germany and Argentina in that same group. Good luck. You know, let's see if Germany and Argentina are developing players at the U-17 level at this point in time who are able to, compete for them years later at the senior team level. I don't think that has happened for them a lot. You know, a big deal was made out of Mexico beating Germany in that 2011 semifinal, I think, for the U-17 World Cup. You know, there were a lot of great stories on that team. You had Sammy Kadira's brother. You had the guys who were scouted out of Turkey when they were 8 years old. And you had players who eventually ended up with the United States. And people over at that program were very excited about. 4 years later, I think Mexico has aged better in that group. So it's not – I think you have to take these groups and these pairings with a grain of salt.
Oh, absolutely.
At the U-17 level. And Mexico should be expected to go through because of the way that they've put an emphasis on youth systems and the way that they've developed these players. But even if they don't, let's say Mexico crashes out of the group stage, there are always lessons that you're going to be learning at this stage and at this point in time. And I think that Mexico, with their two U-17 World Cups, they've now gone through a maturation and a process with the fans and the media that tells you that, you know, even though you might be able to develop a Carlos Vela and a Giovanni Dos Santos and a Hector Moreno during a U-17 process, that doesn't mean that it's going to carry over for you 8 years later and you're going to be winning the World Cup at the senior level. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting tournament, no doubt. I think some teams might benefit a little bit more than others by sending a strong contingent to that. But I think Mexico has gotten to the point where even if they win this tournament, it'll be a fantastic experience for them. You'll have tons of fans cheering for them when they come back. But what does it really do for you, Jason, when you get to the senior level? It doesn't really do anything for you. And even if you are able to graduate, so to speak, 5, 6, 7 players from that team, I don't really think it makes that much of a difference.
Yeah, not only is there a question of the progression of these players, it's not a straight line from U-17 success to senior team and top-level senior club success. You have differences in the way these countries take this tournament on, Eric. As you said, you know, Mexico's put an emphasis on this. You know, Germany knows, for the most part, that they're going to have talent on the senior level. These players might not necessarily be those players, and of course, there are a lot of countries who do put an emphasis on this, others who don't necessarily aren't necessarily exerting the same sort of resources. So it that's something to consider as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I would still think that Mexico, you know, teams like Mexico and the United States, they have a lot to gain from these tournaments because at least now with Carlos Vela and Giovanni Dos Santos and Hector Moreno, and I go back to these guys again because they were pretty much that that breaking point for Mexico in moving from a team that had never won anything to a team that could at least claim a U-17 World Cup. The experience of being there in a high stakes game, I think, is pretty important for a young player. And that sort of thing definitely does carry over. And, you know, it's a place to be seen. If you're a 16-year-old kid, a 17-year-old kid who plays for, I don't know, Morelia or Tijuana, and, you get to play against Germany, and it turns out that the top scout from Borussia Dortmund or from Bayern Munich is there.
Yep.
We've had instances where players move on to Europe because of those tournaments. So I think there is a great value to CONCACAF, to Mexico, to the United States, to be at these type of tournaments and to take them seriously. But to look at that and say, well, you know, we've got two U-17 World Cups and we won the gold medal at the U-23s last Olympics, we're ready for the big time, is definitely kind of a misnomer and something that doesn't happen, at least for Mexico.
Eric Gomez 86 on Twitter. Go follow him. Eric, appreciate the time as always. It's a good time for Mexico right now. We'll obviously see how Juan Carlos Osorio does taking that team into World Cup qualifying, and I'm sure we'll talk to you soon.
Hey, I'll be on when it's not a good time for the Mexico national team.
Right.
Or two.
And I'll be here, hopefully, when it's good for the U.S. national team. yeah. Eric Gomez, good stuff. Thanks a lot, Eric. Let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to John Townsend. Speaking of things not being good for the United States of America, maybe we can figure out why that is right now. Soccer Morning, worldsoccertalk.com.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
Here we go, back on Soccer Morning on a Wednesday. It is the Wednesday, both after the United States loses to Mexico on Saturday and they lose to Costa Rica last night at Red Bull Arena. This is obviously a time to take stock of American soccer, where we stand as a soccer nation and where we're going, and to take a look at some of that and have a discussion about the future of the game in this country. John Townsend joins us now. You find him on Twitter at John, J-O-N underscore Townsend 3. Hi, John. How are you?
Good, Jason. How are you?
Well, spending my days now with lots of discussion about what's wrong with American soccer. And there's clearly a lot wrong with American soccer. I don't know where you'd like to start, but if we have one thing that that you believe feeds into some of the problems that are facing the senior level team, certainly the highest profile example of American soccer, what would that be?
I would say we need to shift our attention toward a more bottoms-up approach instead of a top-down one in the system. So what that means is we're starting to see the evidence of problems that have been there since Jurgen Klinsmann's taken over, maybe before. And I would like to see more of a development-centric approach at the youth level. So I'm always pushing for better youth development initiatives. And part of that is just come out with the 2015 player development mandates. I think that's going to start to bear fruit. But is it too late for this cycle? Probably.
Okay. Well, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. But, I mean, obviously mandates and plans and changes of focus and coaching programs and all of those things are sound great on paper. But I think that what we all recognize here as we talk about this game and we watch our players come through from the youngest levels is, how do we make those things actually matter in a practical manner?
Yeah, no, it's a great way to put it. I think we need a sense of accountability. I think if we're going to talk about the senior most level, I think we got to start with the head of the snake in U.S. soccer, which is Sunil Gulati. I think he's got to be held responsible for putting Jurgen Klinsmann in position. If people think Jurgen Klinsmann is not the answer, I think the person who handed him the keys of the castle needs to be held accountable. I think Jurgen Klinsmann needs to be held accountable. Does that mean he needs to be fired? No, not really to me. I think bringing in another coach right now, it depends on who we bring in. I think I would actually, it might sound radical, but I actually think that if Jurgen Klinsmann is a technical director, I don't know if an American coach wants to work under that, to be honest. I think American players don't get Jurgen Klinsmann, and Jurgen Klinsmann doesn't get the American player.
Okay, well, is that, I mean, is, are you going to lay blame in that situation, or are you just going to take that for what it is and imagine that we may need to be a country that that deals with ourselves in-house for a while longer, the way that we did with certainly Samson, Arena, and Bradley?
Well, I think that there's definitely some accountability that needs to be doled out here. I think Klinsmann needs to be held accountable. I think the players, to some degree, need to be held accountable. And what I mean by sense of accountability is we need to realize that this is a systemic problem. For the past, since Klinsmann came into tenure, I've seen the denigration of the college game. I think a lot of people look at the college game and say, hey, you know, that's not what we want our players to play. And partly they're correct. I mean, I'm a product of the college system. And it's, you know, we ask our young players at 20, the 22 to 18, 18, 22 age group to go play professionally. And that's the first time they're ever playing more than a 3-month season. And it's the first time they're actually getting some sense of the professional game. And I think, you know, what we need, the American soccer system needs, is to have reform at the college level, at the youth level, which we're seeing. But we need to have a sense of accountability of, okay, so how are we preparing these players so when they're 22 years old, they're ready to perform for a Jurgen Klinsmann or anyone else that is brought in? Now, to answer your question about keeping it in-house, I have no problem with an American coach taking the reins and implementing these things and changing the narrative. But what I want to see is more of a there's an analogy that a coaching mentor of mine gave once is we live in a microwave society when we should live in a crockpot society. We need to let things
And
you know what I mean by that. But it's hard when you have results-driven businesses like soccer. It's tough.
As much as I am guilty of responding viscerally to the events of right now and whatever happened most recently, certainly the way things have gone over the last 4 days, you know, that hits me as a fan pretty hard. I also try my best and – hey, you know what? People don't want to wait, John. They don't. They want things to happen now. They want the U.S. program. They look at the population of the country, the number of players that we have, all of these resources that are admittedly vast, and they think that that should immediately become world-class talent in a cycle. And that obviously isn't the way things are going. And I also think that part of our problem as a culture, and this is, you know, my expertise isn't in coaching. My expertise isn't in knowing what's going on at the youth levels in any real detail. But what I can say from the way that we perceive these things is that people imagine this as a straight line progression from 1990, when we first went back to the World Cup after 50 years, to a World Cup title. And not only do they have different ideas of what that time frame should be, they are not accounting for the fact that we are likely to have regression at some point, that this isn't always going to be a straight line. But the question is whether or not we can identify as a soccer culture why that regression is happening, whether or not it's something that we're actively causing, or if there are ways to go about smoothing out those bumps.
Yeah, so I will be the first to admit that 1999 class of U-17s in Bradenton, Florida, in residency was a golden generation for American soccer. I would go on to say that the 2002-2003 class with Michael Bradley, Memo Gonzalez, you know, those players were also, Freddie Adu, were supremely talented. There's been subsequent classes that have been talented, but I think what we fail to do as a country is get those players from that residency type environment, that program, bringing them to fruition and letting them succeed at professional level. Now, I am not going to pretend that this is a straight line approach. It's definitely not. We are going to see, I think, continued regression. I mean, you look at other countries who are struggling as well, but in the American game, our fans tend to look at the results and not the process. And I think Jurgen Klinsmann is guilty of that. One of the things that he did first thing he did coming in my opinion, was he was very abrasive toward what was the system. And he had all the buzzwords, he hit all these points, but what he didn't account for is for so long that served this country's soccer player, that served that journeyman approach, that unglamorous route to the professional level really served our national teams. And you saw it in the playing styles and in the World Cups, the never give up and all that stuff. But he wanted to bring in an attractive style. Well, that's going to take tons of time. And for him, he's poisoned by his own promises and his first press conference. For me, as a critic of the American game, I'm also a product of the American game. And what I like to think about is how can we best reach a middle point here between fans wanting results soon and having the players in the system put in place to enable that positive impact. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder as well if we are guilty as a country of we seem to be at cross purposes in a lot of this, and I think you'll know what I mean here. It's one thing to sort of rail against the system, to have problems with the way we operate, to call for change, and it's another to sort of reject everything that we've done so far and reject everything that's made American soccer what it is. There's a mentality that is we're doing everything wrong, which I think is actually detrimental to American soccer. Yeah, there are some things that we have to change in order to catch up with the rest of the world, but we should at least admit, as you said, that journeyman way of going about becoming a professional player, the college system, being drafted. I mean, that 2002 World Cup team was made up of a bunch of guys who didn't go through youth academies at any professional stripe. Does that mean we should stick with that? No, not necessarily, but we should absolutely recognize that maybe the way that American soccer players are going to develop doesn't have to fall directly lockstep with the way the Dutch are doing it, the way the Spanish are doing it.
Right, we definitely want to follow the Dutch. They've just failed.
No, of course, no. But then again, that's about results at the top level again. And exactly, we know those Dutch academies are still pumping out talent. So yeah.
So here's a great way to look at this, Jason. And I think you and I will agree on this. And this is an important thing that I would love to see more fans in the American game. I always look at the game in little cycles here, and so. Since 2007, when the U.S. Soccer Development Academy came in, everyone was enamored by the buzzwords. You took this label elite, premier, and all that stuff, and you put it on the club side of things, and it didn't really change much initially. But we're starting to see the fruits of the academy system take root at the lower level. Now, what I didn't see in these last two games, and I haven't seen under Klinsmann a lot, is a lot of players who went through that rugged progression and development cycle that we just described, that journeyman college thing. What I saw in previous teams, though, was guys that are accustomed to not having a thing done for them. When you put a player into an academy, they are taken care of. They are given everything they need. They're fed. They're transported. When you put a player through the college system, they're on maybe book vouchers. Some are on full rides. Some aren't. Some have to play on crappy frozen fields in Midwest America where no one's watching. Some of them have to, hope for a scholarship one time in their collegiate career. Some of them don't get drafted. And when those players make it to the professional level, not only are they battle hardened, they're also representing kind of the American story, which is they're tough, they're willing to work, and they're geared toward winning. They're playing in a 3-month season that is all results driven. If you lose three games, you're automatically, at risk of not making the NCAA tournament. So the point I'm trying to make is if we can get for a form at that college level, if we can embrace that system, because that's already the academy system we really need, is that 18 to 22 group. The facilities are there. The coaching is there. We just need to put a season that's, 7-8 months in and figure out a solution and to maybe, and I think that would start to bear fruit, because what I think a lot of Americans want to see is fight. They want to see the American teams under Klinsmann not give up against Mexico, not, back down. And we're used to that. And under Klinsmann, he promised attractive style of soccer, and it kind of let a lot of people down. And I don't disagree with what he tried to do, but I disagree with the way he tried to do it.
Okay. But before we run out of time, John, I think we need to come to one of the crux of the arguments that happens to percolate especially on Twitter. It leads to some discivil, uncivil discourse. And I don't want to make this. We're not fighting here. We're discussing, and that's certainly important to me. But I'll ask the question. I get accused of being in the bag for MLS all the time. I'm certainly as critical of MLS as most people are on sort of actively decrying the existence of the league. So my question to you, because look, it's not just that I remember a time when we didn't have a league. I recognize that there are unique set of circumstances in this country, and I don't want rich guys dictating the game, but I certainly recognize that in the modern world, money drives so much of what's happening. We just need to apply gentle pressure or significant pressure, but in certain areas, rather than sort of just foaming at the mouth about the way things operate. So I'm going to ask you bluntly, is MLS a detriment to American soccer?
It is not a detriment to American soccer. It is not the... Let me think about it this way. Would you want the... we'll answer the question. Do you think it's in the best interest of the Welsh FA to pay Gareth Bale and Aaron Ramsey about £6 million a year to come play in the League of Wales with journeymen on £30 grand a year to better the system? Or should they leave them at Real Madrid and Arsenal playing against the best competition they should get? Okay. That's what I ask about MLS. Like,
sure.
You brought all these guys back. Do I think it's a detriment to American soccer? No, I was at the first MLS game in the Spartan Stadium as a ball boy. I watched Eric Rinaldo, the mega guy, put it side netting. My father did photography for the Chicago Fire. I went to so many home games. I have great memories with MLS. However, at a certain point, like most kids who grew up with the league, you wanted to see this maturation that I think didn't happen.
Okay.
It's not at the detriment of American soccer. Sure. I feel like there's a lot of angst there.
Okay.
I think MLS, has helped the American soccer, talent pool. I think it's given us something to watch. I think it could be better than it is, though.
Okay, fair enough. I think what we're dealing with, though, is a problem of, and maybe this is cross purposes for a time that it'll eventually resolve itself, or you hope that it will resolve itself. Certainly, people running MLS imagine that one day it will. The idea of bringing top level American players back to MLS, paying them more money than they would make anywhere else, to them is, you know, a long range plan that maybe this helps us get where we want to go with this league so that one day it is good enough for our players to be here and be at the top of their game. So essentially what we have is a disagreement over whether or not it's smart to take your lumps now by bringing Bradley and Dempsey and some of these guys, Altidore, whoever, back to MLS. Or if you should, you know, as you said, leave them in Europe, certainly allow them to, or don't give them the incentive to come back on big money so that they are scrapping for whatever they can in Europe, because that makes the national team. But again, we're sort of just talking about different approaches to hopefully the same resolution.
Right. I think that's a great way to put it. I mean, we all want the same thing, right? No matter where you come from in this game, if you follow the game in the American soccer circle, which is still marginalized, you want the same thing. You want success. Now, listen, I played on the same club teams as a lot of the guys that are playing in MLS now. I understand what they're going through. They're humans. You know, if they're offered a contract they can't turn down, I don't blame them. You know, this isn't about dehumanizing the MLS player. I mean, get a payday like that, to get security like that. These are humans. And so what we need to understand in this country is, okay, so if we look at MLS as a launching pad toward better leagues, I would rather we prepare our players. We raise our baseline talent, so the top has to raise itself. Does that make sense? And so I'm not looking at these guys coming back as the main reason. It does play a part. You know, it does play a part. Anyone would see that Jozy Altidore was doing so well in Holland. He came to England, and it's like, okay, well, that wasn't good. And then maybe in MLS he's doing a little bit better. But, you know, MLS is actually the least of what should be people's worries right now. It has to be at the bottom. It has to be that fundamental change. The coaching education's got to be better. And, you know, we can't blame a league for existing. How it runs itself, who runs it. Yeah, we can start to hold them accountable, but I would love to see a more robust league system within the United States outside of MLS and MLS. MLS is able to do what it wants. I would love to see the other leagues rise up and push the talent, you know, because at the end of the day, Jason, we all want the same thing, which is success.
And let's remember that this is a complicated thing. My job is to sit here every day and try to distill it. But look, it's almost impossible for any one person in an hour a day or 3 hours a day, whatever you have available, to express these things in simple terms. There is no, I continue to say this, there is no magic solution to any of this. You can't wave a wand, fix one thing, and suddenly American soccer is on the path to world domination. It's not going to work that way. And while it's certainly fair to ask more of the people that are running our game in our country, let's remember that most people have the best interests of the game at heart. Even if you think, well, those greedy bastards running MLS, they also put a lot of money into that league to keep it going. Again, the question of how it runs, the philosophical elements of it, we'll never agree on all of that. That's or they'll never agree with us as fans as to how we want to see that go. I think that some people waste energy, again, foaming at the mouth rather than sort of not accepting, but working within what we've got, or at least saying to themselves, okay, this is the practical reality. Let me see if I can be effective making my arguments in a way that doesn't necessarily alienate half the people. Let's try that. Can we try that?
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, and I think, you know, 10, 15 years ago, we didn't have a platform for these discussions.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, I see that as progress itself.
There you go. John, I got to wrap. John Townsend, go follow him on Twitter, JON_Townsend3. These footy times, he's a coach and a writer, and it's a good discussion. I appreciate the time, John. Good stuff.
I appreciate you having me on. Thanks.
All right. There goes John Townsend. Let's take a break. When we come back, take some of your phone calls on any of the things that have happened today. You want to talk about the Dutch? Let's talk about the Dutch. I don't want to dance on their graves necessarily, but my God. Soccer Morning, worldsoccertalk.com.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
Man, that song is unintentionally appropriate. Look at that. That's just amazing how that stuff works. Soccer Morning on a Wednesday. Phone lines now open 646-832-3909. Aaron is first up. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, how you doing? It's 24 hours since we talked.
Can't get enough of me, Aaron.
Yeah, that's it. You want to talk about the Dutch, which I think would be great, because I actually disagree with a lot of what John Townsend said. If you look at the Dutch right now, they're exactly in that same position that we find ourselves in. Obviously, we're not to the same level, but you could argue, you know, Robert Van Persie is, you know, Josie Altidore right now, and Iron Robin is Clint Dempsey, and, you know, and if you don't make this massive switch to youth before these type of events happen, where you get kind of stuck in your World Cup or your Euro qualifying cycle or Gold Cup, and our version of the Euro is the Gold Cup. Basically you wind up losing years.
Yeah.
Because those youth players have to kind of, you know, not just, you know, show up. I mean, I think one of the worst things we do with soccer is we try to treat it like all other sports. I've always thought of soccer as more like acting, meaning the kind of way you have to hone a craft, the way you have to kind of go through the, you know, you have to earn your chops through, you know, theater. And I'm not saying once in a while, you know, someone doesn't fall out of the sky and become a superstar, but that can't be your strategy if you're a movie studio
or if
you're a producer or a director. Your strategy has to be to depend on, you know, arguably the academy, the theater and the more kind of technical, you know, indie movie.
Well, that's
et cetera. And the Dutch do that really well.
Right. That's certainly the
sorry.
That's, well, I just want to throw in here. That's certainly the long view approach, the necessary long view approach. And I think what John and I sort of approached it, looked at, drilled down on, is that American soccer, and I've thrown this theory out there before. I really believe that we were sort of spoiled by that class of 99, which he called a golden generation, which in my mind just means that it's sort of remarkable that those players all came together at that time. Does it mean that Braden,
I kind of call it a bronze generation.
Okay,
I
sure,
mean, if I'm
sure,
being
fair,
honest
fair.
About it.
Well, relatively speaking, it's an American golden generation, meaning that it's the best we've had to this point. Why not give them that credit? But you know, it's not that Bradenton or our systems or our clubs didn't have something to do with the way those players developed. They certainly did, but at the same time, it was almost more happenstance that we got a Donovan and Onyewu, a Beckerman, whoever. I mean, that group in general, the Bobby Convies, that group was, but Convy was later, but that group was certainly, and even that 2002 team and the makeup of that team with McBride and O'Brien and Claudio Reyna, these guys were, I don't know, unique in an American sense, in that they were punching above the American weight. So now what we've established,
yeah,
what we've established over the course of the last decade and a half, is we've become more entrenched in trying to develop those players. And I don't know that it's that we're doing it entirely wrong. It's just that there's a necessary leveling off. Where we have more of them, they're not reaching that same level. And again, we were sort of spoiled by that. I don't know why. I mean,
I would argue that we didn't have as many institutions that pulled at players.
Right. Okay.
And I mean, really, the truth was, I mean, high school soccer is a joke now, but it was the only thing outside of your kind of regional club team. And then ODP, your state ODP, kind of was like the Dutch. I'm not saying quite like the Dutch. It was more like a Dutch, colony, but it was more like a Dutch system where you kind of pooled the best players once a year, and they kind of went away for, 5 days to 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And then college was this system that was getting ramped up. And to get ramped up, you had to bring in either two kinds of people, ex-football coaches who failed, American football coaches, and then you replaced them with soccer guys. And in the beginning, a lot of them were European or South American.
Right.
And with them, they kind of brought their other players. I think what's gone on is that's kind of the Silicon Valley mode of starting soccer in America. And then once, NCAA took over, I'm not saying they weren't NCAA before, but you know what I mean. Once it became kind of part of the AD system, not this weird foreigner kind of concept, then you got this kind of another internal portfolio piece you have to meet a metric on. And, if you look at the complete implosion of high school and college soccer, which people say, oh, big deal, you're sucking out of the eight most important years out of development. And forget about soccer players. What if you had a violinist and had to go do high school, violin class and then college violin class? Would they make anyone symphony orchestra?
I think
they just wouldn't.
What's occurring to me is, and again, not that those were better systems in terms of producing players in a theoretical sense, but what we had there in the late 90s, we had a very clear path. This is how it worked. There were only so many there were only a few John O'Briens, the guys who went overseas, joined an academy, came through it that way.
Yep.
Most of these guys, and Landon Donovan was unique too, but most of these guys were, as you said, club soccer, high school soccer, college soccer, professional soccer, and it streamlined that process. Now it was like a funnel, and the funnel was relatively narrow at the bottom, but we were extracting the most out of this group because there were only so many places to focus. We were able to identify in very clear areas. Okay, this is a place I look. This is a place I look. This is a place I look. And now we got this talent. Now we have opened up.
Yeah.
We have opened up this.
Yeah,
this
the problem though is that we were always extracting individual units. And then I go back to the other arts, because I really do believe in the concept that football is art. Soccer is art. Because of the way you have to choreograph, when it's done right, it's highly choreographed, whether it's Barcelona or Bayern Munich, whatever. And, at the most extreme, edges, like a New York Symphony Orchestra. And the problem is when you put, a first, second, third chair, rock stars together, that doesn't mean the violin section is going to play well. Arguably, it won't. There won't be any chemistry there. And the problem is when we pick all these kind of individuals without understanding, what are we really trying to build? Are we trying to build a 4-3-3 in the United States? And for the next decade, we go all in and we go 4-3-3 everywhere. And if you don't implement 4-3-3 in your club or in your high school or your college, you lose some of this national money or some of the support, so that it bends everybody towards some generic outcomes. So yeah, you can get a destroyer midfielder. So you can get a certain type of flanking player. And see, most of the world, and I actually think Costa Rica last night, we did great against Costa Rica. Everyone likes, I mean, I don't think we played great, but we did great as a result. And the reason is, Costa Rica's goalkeeper is the Real Madrid goalkeeper. All right? You know, there's no one, except for Chicharito, who made the roster. There's no one in, out of 500 million people in North America, who could make Real Madrid's team, except, you know, Keylor Navas, and he starts for them.
Yeah.
So the idea that we lose 1-0 against Real Madrid's goalkeeper, okay, and a bunch of pretty solid squad players, including a couple others that play for Everton and Arsenal, sure, and Campbell, et cetera, I think we did great with a younger roster. We turned it over 50,000 times like we always do. But basically, you know, it's like what we do is like pile on in America when we don't get results in soccer. And that works. I don't know if it works, but we're used to it in other sports. But soccer is such a developmental game, requires so many years. I go back to theater and acting and music, because it's a lot more like that than it is like baseball or football. I'm not saying hitting in baseball or pitching is kind of like that. But
Aaron,
it's like, you know, sorry.
No, I got to wrap you up because I got some other people waiting and we're running out of time. So, I mean, yep, it's a great discussion. And again, I got to let you go. I think that there's something to be said for the efficiency level. I mean, it's a word I come back to many times when we talk about developing players. We may not have been efficient to the point of world-class talent in the late 90s, early 2000s, but what we were is very narrowly focused on a couple of areas. It's always available to us. Now we've opened up a fire hose, and because of that, it's more difficult to pick out, to pick out those elements. And again, Aaron makes a good point about or John made a good point about the path of the player, how they have to work, what they have to work for. You know, a lot of talk about players' heads getting big, and maybe that's part of it too. I don't know. Lots of issues here. Alan in Kansas City, you're on the air.
You know, it's interesting. Over the past week, all I hear is we don't have world-class talent. You know, we don't have anything developed. And then I look back at some of the coaches in MLS, and I wonder if we place somebody such as a Peter Vermes in either the technical director role or the head coach role, and see the things that he's done in Kansas City, where he has scouted local talent and worked with them and turned Matt Beisler into one of the best defenders in North America. He's taken Graham Zusi right out of college, somebody that nobody was really trying to draft, and turn him into who he was. He's developed a lot of local kids into playing for a club-level team. He's put out 4 to 5 individuals that he recruited this year, or individuals that were maybe not in their prime, but has turned them around. He definitely has impacted individuals like Betty Philhaber, who was, you know, quite frankly, kind of washed up when he was within the New England Revolution. He was overweight, not playing very well, and he's turned him into an MVP. So, you know, I disagree with this notion that we can't turn things around. And maybe it's somebody like Peter Vermes that we need in the team that doesn't have to have stars, but can put together a good, cohesive team that can win things.
Yeah,
and that's what he's done in Kansas City.
I don't know if Peter Vermes is the answer. He's the name that comes to mind most easily for me, Alan. I think that I don't agree that the cupboard is bare. And when I say that, what I mean is I don't agree that there isn't something in the American talent pool that can get us back to where we want to go. The question is how do you take that talent out of the cupboard and hone it into something that works together as a unit, that works together within a system that you're teaching, you know, whether or not we have one national curriculum or not, which, by the way, sounds almost impossible because of the individual nature of Americans in general. But, you know, there's something there. Alan, I got to run, but anything else before I let you go?
No, man, I'm just looking forward to MLS and tired of talking about the national.
Fair enough. Appreciate it. Let's hope that this last call isn't a gloating call. My man Eddie in Brooklyn, what's up?
Yeah, I kind of want to respond to the last two callers now real quick. Well, you guys can't hire Peter Vermes because he's kind of a prick.
Sure.
You, after Klinsmann, you want a likable guy as the coach. I would look at Jesse Marsh after he wins the double this year. He'd be a great candidate.
Okay.
Right. And And then the caller before, where you said that you guys did good against Costa Rica, second half, you guys were absolute trash. The only reason why it was 1-0 is because of a couple of, you know, last line blocks. And Ureña is absolutely worthless as a striker. And he may try to make the point about Navas. We also have guys like Matarita, David Guzman, David Vega, you know, guys that are in their young 20s playing in the local leagues in Costa Rica. So, for every Navas that we have, we've also done a really good job since the World Cup of incorporating a lot of younger local guys along with our core. So we have something to push for in 2018. And we're not relying on DeMarcus Beasley or Kyle Beckerman in a very big game. So it's just a difference in philosophy.
Why are you coming on my show to kick me while I'm down, Eddie? Why you got to do that, man?
I'm just responding to the callers. I actually want to tell you how depressing your show has been for the last 2 days. And I was trying to change it up by talking about some good stuff like Los Toros, right. New York.
Yeah, no. Look, and that's the thing. I mean, it's not all bad. Let's be fair about this. The national team isn't going well right now for the United States, and there's bad results and everything else. But man, there's some good soccer to be played. There's some good soccer to watch. Toronto can clinch against your boys tonight. You think that's going to happen?
If I don't think Javinko is going to actually play.
No, I don't think so either.
I don't think Josie will play. So they're bare up. Now they're going to be bare moving forward. They're bare under the back line. I kind of liken this game to 2013 when we had to travel to Houston and we were like on the verge of getting the supporter shield. I kind of see some parallels between these two games, and I kind of feel like we pull it out. Toronto can't defend to begin with, but if they can't attack also, I can see the 3 points. I'm trying not to get ahead of myself.
Sure. And look,
talk me out of it.
Stranger things have happened, but yeah, when you're talking about a Toronto team that's going to be relying on Osorio and Robbie Finley to be the league, and I don't know, Hercules Gomez, he should be playing tonight. Hopefully he's playing. Want to see Herc on the field. No offense.
Hercules Gomez's Twitter game is better than his actual game.
Hey, man.
I'm just saying.
It's an interesting end to the season. All right, I don't know. I kind of railroaded you there. I don't know if that's where you wanted to go. What else you got before I wrap this up?
We can win. Do you think we win the Shield by Sunday? If you had a bet for it right now, that would put us at 60 points, which is the max FC Dallas could get, and they have Vancouver tonight.
Yeah.
Do you think the Rebels clinch the Shield by Sunday?
I think it's probably more likely than not at this point. You've got FC Dallas in pole position because they've got a game in hand, right? Right now. I mean, that game is tonight.
But... No. They're 3 points. They're 3 points back if we have the same amount of games.
No. I meant on the West. So they've got the pole position in the West. But they can only max out at what? What'd you say? They can only max out at 60, right? And tiebreaker is going to be wins. So that would put them.
They would be tied.
Yeah. Everything would be tied and. What's the tiebreaker?
Which we have a better one.
What is it? Goal differential? Yeah, I think probably because LA is behind the curve because of games. Vancouver behind the curve because of games. And if the Red Bulls can get to 60, yeah, then it could be done. They've been my favorite for a while now, Eddie. So I expect them to wrap it up.
All right,
I appreciate it, man. Good
there
call.
We go. There it goes. Stuff.
Eddie in Brooklyn. He's look, you know. He's a Costa Rica fan. They get the win last night. CONCACAF getting very, very interesting these days. Mexico, the Kings, United States trying to figure out exactly how to play soccer again. Maybe one day we'll get there. Lots of issues in the world of American soccer. It is what it is. Thank you very much to Eric Gomez and John Townsend. Good show today. Let's wrap this up. Follow us on Twitter at Soccer Morning, and we'll talk to you guys. We'll talk to you guys tomorrow, Thursday. Hopefully Thursday feels better than Wednesday. That's really loud. Let me get that down. Hopefully Thursday feels better than Wednesday. We can head into a good weekend. Lots of MLS tonight on the weekend. NASL coming down to the wire. International soccer, European qualifiers, Premier League, club soccer's back in Europe. We'll talk about all of it later. Disappear. What I put my heart on every cursive letter. Tell me why the hell no one is here.